This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Later in the program, we'll talk about what's in the works for the Finley Community Center in Over the Rhine. But first, Denny Kato is a third-generation Japanese-American, born and raised in Cincinnati. He earned a BA from the University of Cincinnati in 1971 after graduating from Walnut Hills High School, and after college served in the U.S. Army as a first lieutenant in military intelligence. After retiring from restaurant management, he began researching his family history and learning more about how thousands of people of Japanese descent were forced from their homes during World War II and placed in internment camps. Now he lectures about what he's learned and posts news about the camps on his Facebook page, called Beyond Barbed Wire. Denny Kato joins me now to discuss his work in this chapter in American history. Thanks so much for being here, Denny.
Thank you, Lucy.
This segment is pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls. Denny, I want to ask you first, when did you first become aware of this part of your family history? Do you remember as a child kind of first learning about this?
Well, with a lot of my parents' generation, they were very reticent about talking about these incidents. If I asked a question, they would give me a specific answer, but they really didn't elaborate. So for many years, I just had little snippets of information. And of course, I learned a little bit through school, but I just had a very small amount of information. And as I became more aware and I became more involved with other Japanese Americans, I got a little bit more of an interest in it and did a little bit more research. But again, my interest really lay dormant for a number of years. I was married, was raising a family, was moving quite a bit with the restaurant companies I was working for. So I really didn't have any focus at that particular point. But I just retired. This is back in 2014. And my wife, Janet, who had been continuing to do research and actually was spearheading she started interviewing some of my relatives about the incidents and what their experiences were. And so she had this interest before I did, as far as getting deeper. And I remember she asked me, she said, "Do you want to go to the Heart Mountain Pilgrimage in Wyoming in the summer?" And I was kind of unsure what she was talking about, and she explained. I said, "Well, sure, we can do that." And so we kind of tied it in. We wanted to go out to Yellowstone and do some traveling. So we said, "Well, we'll just work it in that way." So we ended up going to the Heart Mountain Pilgrimage, which is basically a once-a-year gathering where they would get together with the incarcerees, and there'd be guest speakers, and you get the tour of the facilities. And so when I went there, I was kind of like amazed when I was talking to some of the people that were actually interned at Heart Mountain. And I was in a workshop group, and they were talking about some issues that I had never heard of. Mm. And it really kind of sparked my interest at that particular point. I said, I never knew that. And I was thinking, oh, I know all about the internment. Mm-hmm. And it turns out I knew very, very little. Mm. So after that pilgrimage, my wife and I made a vow to visit all 10 locations, which we eventually did over the next 4 or 5 years. Mm. And then I set out to do two things. One, learn more about my family and what their involvement was with the internment. And then coinciding with that, I was starting to learn and pick up a lot of information that I didn't know about the internment and all the factors that went into it and the players and so on. So that started it. And over the last 8 years, I have just been compiling research, talking to people, and it's become a passion for me to be able to go out and talk about this kind of dark chapter in American history, and let people know of the details and what happened and how it happened. And it's been very gratifying in that sense. Mm.
And now, I thought I had seen somewhere that as a child, the other school children didn't believe you when you told them this had happened to your family. Is that an experience you had?
Yes. You got to remember, when I was going to grade school, which would have been, in the mid-50s, mm-hmm. The war had only ended for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, and there was very little about the camps at all. I mean, at that particular juncture, I don't think anybody knew about the camps. I was certainly taught at that level of school. I know that in high school, even though I did go to a very good high school, mm-hmm. The amount of time that was spent on the discussion of the camps was probably about 5 minutes.
Wow.
So when finding out, people would, you know, it'd be like incredulous, like, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean they were in prison? What mm-hmm. what happened? And I would tell them, you know, they were taken from their homes and put in the camps. But that really was the extent of it during, learning at school.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until later that I got a little bit more interest, but I still ran into it. And I still run into it as an adult. I think most people acknowledge the fact that there was a camp or camps, and but they really don't know the details. Mm-hmm. So part of what I try to do is try to educate people in terms of how extensive it was and what it, you know, cost to the people who actually went.
Right. And you mentioned that your wife really began interviewing some family members about their experiences. Did you get to talk in much depth to parents, grandparents, other relatives who had, you know, lived experience in these camps?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, I didn't really get fired up about it, let's say, until most of them passed. And I missed great opportunities to personally talk to them about their experiences. I have one uncle who's still living, and I've been able to speak with him on occasion about his experiences at camp. But again, they're very limited. Now, my wife had picked up the baton, so to speak, because I remember we were talking one day, and I told her about my parents' experiences, and she was flabbergasted. She says, "What are you talking about?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Yeah, they were forced from their homes and put in the camps." And she absolutely had no idea.
Mm.
So that was her wake-up call. And she said, "Well, I'm going to start talking to your relatives to see if I can get information." But my parents volunteered a little bit of time, and some relatives did. But they, again, were very reluctant to speak about their experiences. So she was the one that actually started me down this road. With getting the interest and getting me to actually get on board and go ahead with this.
Yeah. And so your parents, were they children when they were in the camps then?
No. My parents were about 20 years old. So they were born in 1922. So they were about 20 years old when they went to camp. And it varied. I had an uncle who was, I think, 13. So the ages varied in terms of, as far as my family's concerned.
Yeah. And did your parents already know each other before they were in the camps, or did they meet after that, or what was their story?
Well, my father grew up in Broderick, California, which is west of Sacramento. And my mother's family lived in Dunsmuir, California, which is northern California, just really near Mount Shasta.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually didn't meet until they went to what's called an assembly center at Merced, California.
Hmm.
There were 15 assembly centers where they were bringing the Japanese prior to their being sent to the permanent camps. So they met in Merced, and that was, I guess, the beginning of their romance.
Hmm.
And the two families, my father's family and my mother's family, were then transferred to the camp in what was first known as Granada Relocation Center in Colorado. And that camp changed its name to Amache a little bit later, but that's where they met, and at Merced. And then I guess they continued their relationship when they got into camp.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if, and I know you said you didn't get to talk to them much, but I had the opportunity a number of years ago to meet a woman who had been in the camp, and she had a daughter born in the camp, and she never certainly didn't glorify the experience in the camp or say anything like that it was a good experience, but she said this one beautiful thing came out of it, and that was the birth of her daughter, Carol. And she saw that as almost like a silver lining or a little bit of joy that she could find in this terrible experience. Did your parents ever talk about that? I mean, they did meet each other and kind of find each other, and I'm not saying that justifies anything that happened, but I guess I wonder if they saw that as a little bit of happiness they found.
My mother was always the eternal optimist.
Mm-hmm.
And she, when I discussed the camps with her, she said, she kind of prefaced it by saying, well, you know, it was a bad deal. And then she'd always add a but. She'd go, but we did get to meet people. Obviously, I met your father. And, you know, then she would say, well, then after the war, we were able to disperse, and so the Japanese population was just on the West Coast. So but she always tried to find that, that's literally the silver lining in it, and that was her attitude. And my father, conversely, he did volunteer for the 442nd. So his experience in terms of camp was a little more focused on his military experience. And he did say that his time in the military was the best time of his life. So, I mean, there are some tidbits of I guess, remembrance that are not negative from their experience. And it's different with both of my parents.
Sure. Well, and it seems to me that it can be kind of human nature to try to find some joy even in the most difficult and harrowing experience. So so you mentioned your father's service. You also served in the military. Talk to me a little bit about, did you have any trouble kind of reconciling that, whether, you know, this is a country that did this horrible thing to members of your family, and then you volunteered and served the country. Did when you enlisted, did you feel like, oh, this would never happen again? I mean, how did you work through, or did you feel like you needed to work through any of those feelings?
Well, I know that if I were 18 or 18 or 20 years old, I would have not have served. If I were in the camp, I would have said, hell no, I'm not going to go. Because that's the way we were raised, you know, in that time frame. I didn't really have any reservations. I had enrolled in ROTC, ROTC, when I was at the University of Cincinnati. And so I had committed from that particular point to be in the military. I really didn't have any thoughts about what had happened in World War II. I basically kind of put that aside and said, well, that was then, and let's move on. And I didn't have any qualms about my military service.
Yeah. What made you interested in beginning to share this knowledge and this research with other people publicly? You have this Facebook page. What inspired you to start doing that?
Well, what happened is that I was a good friend of mine from high school had contacted me and said, do you have any people who can give talks on the camps? And she's from Cincinnati, and she was associated with the Art Institute of Cincinnati. And so I gave her a couple of names, and I said, well, here, try these people and, you know, see if they can do it for you. And she called me back and said, well, I wasn't able to find anybody. And so I stopped and I said, well, you know what? I'll tell you what. Let me put something together. I said, it'll be good. Don't worry. It won't be just a, you know, kind of a mishmash. And I said, I've been doing the research for 4 or 5 years. I've got the information. Let me put together a PowerPoint for you, and I'll get back with you. So I did, and this was about 2 years ago. I came up to Cincinnati, and I did the presentation for her at the Art Institute of Cincinnati, and went over really, really well. So I thought at that particular point, you know, I can continue to do this. And so I went ahead and tried to expand it. And then about a year ago, I was contacted by the OLLI, which is Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, at the University of South Florida. And they asked me, can you do a presentation on the camps? And I said, well, sure. And he said, well, but it's got to be 4 2-hour lectures.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm like, I was thinking, okay, my initial report was 90 minutes. How am I going to get 8 hours out of this report? Well, I did. And I've been doing it. I'm due for my third lecture with them, or fourth lecture with them in June. So I was able to expand it. And so I thought, well, with Facebook, that might give me a little bit more exposure. I could continue to put informational pages out and kind of teach the people through the pages of the Facebook of some of the incidents, some of the camp stories, and some of the things that went on. So just another way. And then, of course, of gaining some publicity in it so that people could say, well, you know, maybe you could do a talk for me.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Later in the program, we'll talk about plans underway to redevelop an important community center in Over the Rhine. But first, we continue our conversation with Denny Cotto about what he's learned about the U.S. internment camps where thousands of people of Japanese descent were forced to live during World War II. So you were talking before the break about this Facebook group you have and how you've been sharing information with people for years now. What surprises people most when they hear you speak about what you've learned?
I think that there's a number of misconceptions that people have. I remember I ran into a couple of guys when I was out in California, and I told them I was doing some research on this particular project, and they said, "Oh, the camps, right?" And their comment was, "Well, they weren't too bad, were they?"
Mm.
And I was taken aback a little bit. And I said, "Well, I don't know. If you consider being behind barbed wire and armed guards and being in prison not too bad and having your liberty taken away, I guess it's not too bad, is it?" And he was like a little bit shocked that I would answer him that way. But I try not to be overly critical of people who are I'm not going to say ignorant, but are not apprised of the facts. And I think that what people do end up finding out is in terms of they have the general idea that the people went to camp, but they really don't know some of the stories of like how the conditions were or, you know, what happened to their property. You know, it was sold. What happened to their pets and things of that nature.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay. And like my mother had to give up her dog,
aww,
as did everybody that mm-hmm. went to camp. You could sneak them in later, but initially you couldn't. So there are just some details that people pick up on in terms of, oh, I didn't. They always come up to me after my lectures and say, oh, I didn't know that's happened. And so it's kind of refreshing in a way to know that, you know, I'm giving them some information they didn't have before.
Sure. Let's talk about some of those details that people pick up on. Talk to us about what happened to people's property when they were taken to these camps. And, you know, then you mentioned it was sold. What happened to the proceeds?
Well, here's what happened with them. They were given notice after the executive order was initially given out on February 19th. They were given about 2 weeks to get their affairs in order. And they were a head of the household had to come to a central location and register.
Mm.
In the meanwhile, if you had a business, you tried to sell the business or sell the goods as quickly as you could, or you signed over your business if you had one. If you had a Caucasian friend or perhaps someone of Chinese descent who wasn't going to be subject to this, you signed over power of attorney for your business. Well, some of them worked out. Some of them worked out okay. Others, you know, like Fujiwara produce became John Smith produce.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the property that was sold was either given away or got pennies on the dollar. Bank accounts were seized, particularly of the Japanese nationals. So you basically had to put your affairs in order, grab what you could, take what you could money-wise, and then report to these camps. And the thing with the camps, they were given a identification tag. And you had to put the identification tag on your luggage and on your person. So when you see pictures of the people going to the assembly centers, they all have these little yellow tags. And they had a family number. And then each individual family member had a letter prefix to go with it. So it was 2 weeks to put your affairs in order. Some of the people did okay. I mean, and when I say did okay, they managed to retain their business. People took care of their business for them while they were away. Others weren't so lucky. Like mm-hmm. My father's parents, they were tenant farmers. Of course, they didn't lose their land per se, but they lost all their possessions. My grandfather's bank account was seized, so he lost that. My mother's family, on the other hand, My grandfather was working for the Southern Pacific Railroad, and he learned about the war on, obviously, everybody else on December 7th. And on December 8th, he was fired from the Southern Pacific because he was Japanese. Mm. He happened to be in Sacramento at the time, and he was asked to leave the train. So he had to find his way back to Dunsmuir, and he was told he had 2 weeks to vacate his house that was given. He was allowed to stay on the premises with the Southern Pacific Railroad. So he was given 2 weeks. Fortunately, they were able to, my grandmother had worked for a motel, so the owners were very generous in offering them a place to stay. So they had six people staying in this, you know, cabin for several months. So, I mean, whatever property they had to get rid of. Some of the neighbors allowed them to keep the property in storage. Mm. But my mother's family never returned to Dunsmuir, so their property, I guess, was just taken over by whoever they left it with.
Mm-hmm. As you started to learn more about this yourself, what was your emotional reaction to kind of this flood of information that you started to get more and more of, you know, later in your life? Did you have a kind of a gut reaction to this?
Well, I was a little bit shocked in terms of the depths and to what extent this incarceration went. But as I got more information, it just became validation for what I was doing. And it became really a goal to learn more. And I constantly pick up information and insert it into my presentations because it's just something that it's come up and it's been so important. I need to alter it and put it in. And this is a matter of fact, of the presentation I gave Sunday, I did a last edit a week before. Hmm. So again, it's just that I pick up this information and I kind of go through it and go, well, okay, I really need to put this in. So I'm being surprised all the time about extent of information and what happened and some of the public figures that were involved. It's like a web of conspiracy almost in terms of how deep it was.
Yeah. Do you think something like this could ever happen again in the United States?
Well, that's one of my preachings is, you know, one of the phrases that I use is never again. I caution myself to think that it could. For instance, a lot of people think that the court overturning the convictions of Korematsu and some of the other people who were involved with their cases ended this particular episode. Mm-hmm. Well, it ended this episode, but it did not eliminate from the legal part of the incarceration that it can happen again. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. Supreme Court never did directly rule on whether or not the ability of the U.S. government to gather people by group and put them in prison, even though they're citizens, that particular legality is still present today. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I try to emphasize with my audience and with the people who read these reports, that this could happen again. It legally could happen again today.
Well, and tell us one more time, if people want to learn more about your work, where do they find you on Facebook?
Well, I'm on my Facebook page is titled Beyond Barbed Wire, and it's a public group. And I do share a number on my own pages, but you can go and you can ask, obviously, to come onto the group, and we approve you. And you can look at the posts, but you can also put on posts. And I do share a number of posts from other groups that are similar in nature. I have a number of groups that are associated with Japanese Americans and Japanese veterans and so on. And so I go through those pages and go to those groups religiously. And then if I find a posting that is good for my page, I'll share it on my page. And so it does give a little broader audience to some of the information.
Yeah, so many fascinating historic photos, and I was looking at that page myself. Well, I'd like to thank my guest, Cincinnati native and third-generation Japanese-American Denny Kato. Up next, we'll talk about what's in the works for the Findlay Community Center in Over the Rhine. This is Cincinnati Edition.